You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Tuesday, April 28th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. I should say we're steps and steps and steps. On the program today, professor of history, director of the European Institution at Columbia University, Adam Tooze, on the normal economy never coming back. Also on the program today, PDB part deux. Trump ignored more than one dozen presidential briefings warning of the coronavirus epidemic. Meanwhile, new corroboration of the Joe Biden accusations threatened to blow up his nomination. The Paycheck Protection Plan collapses almost immediately. Small Business Administration systems. And good news, testing capacity is growing across the country. Bad news, Mitch McConnell wants to strip worker and consumer protections in the next coronavirus bailout bill. Meanwhile, return of, I want to come up with return of the crybaby? I don't know. Trump pushes back, insists on still having his briefings. More Amazon worker protests. Meanwhile, New York AG says their precautions inadequate. Navy releases images of an unidentified aerial phenomena, or multiple ones, I guess. And tragedy strikes. Diamond and Silk, dumped by Fox News. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the program, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. Glad you could make it. And we got a lot of stuff to cover today. We'll try and get to some phones. Nomi Konst is going to be joining us in the fun half of the program this afternoon, as she tends to do, coming directly from her Noma Key show studio, I guess, annex, as it were. We're all in our annex studios these days. And for how long, we don't know. We're going to talk about new story, I guess really more corroboration of the Joe Biden accusations. And I'm beside myself. I don't really know what to, I know what to talk about with this stuff, but, the latest report is in Business Insider by a guy named McHugh, I think it is. And, he is a reporter who basically was Ronan Farrow's partner producer on the work that Ronan Farrow did. I think now they're competitors of some sorts, but in terms of reporting. But these allegations, or I should say this last round of reporting, because it's found two new people to corroborate the accusations, more or less contemporaneous, that it appears there is going to be increased at least awareness and pressure. We shall see where that goes. Simultaneously, of course, New York State decided to cancel the presidential primary. There's still other races going on. And it's, I think they were talking about doing this vote by mail in June. But they shut the door rather quickly. So we will see how that goes. In the meantime, let's get to the, and then, you know, we'll talk about Donald Trump ignoring the presidential briefings that were coming from the intel community. We got to worry about coronavirus. Got to worry about coronavirus. Got to worry about coronavirus. I'm not going to repeat it 12 times, but that's how many PDBs he got. And, you know, this stuff, of course, will implicate the election as well. So we have this sort of dynamic that is a little bit scary, frankly, that we saw in 2016, which was two candidates possibly getting less and less popular as we get closer to the election. And we know that Donald Trump has a base that will allow him to, you know, shoot people in the middle of Fifth Avenue. We shall see how strong support is for Joe Biden, perhaps. Meanwhile, let's get on to this horrible news. Let's just, this is very upsetting. This story about Diamond and Silk. Do we have any footage of Diamond and Silk? Do we have any of their tweets that they got fired for?
I don't know if they've come out publicly
well,
with a statement.
Apparently, it sounds like Diamond and Silk. Now, where do I have this number 10 here in my pile? Diamond and Silk, the famed duo, Lynette Diamond Arriaway and Rochelle Silk Richardson. They have they started out as Trump, just major Trump supporter, video supporters. They went on to a Fox News guest, and then they had a regular role with the network. Apparently, they have been cut from Fox Nation, which is the online Fox screening thing. They have been tweeting about, of course, which everyone I think takes for granted now, that coronavirus was basically born from 5G technology. That is, the cell phone technology created the virus. And then the apparently Diamond and Silk also said they'd avoid taking a coronavirus vaccine if Bill Gates is involved because he pushed for population control. Apparently, according to the Daily Beast, they will not be on Fox anymore because of those conspiracy theories. Now, of course, when you do your conspiracy theories, you really can't get that specific on Fox News. But let's go back to one of the great hits that Diamond and Silk gave us. And this was from February 2019 when they were attacking Cory Booker for his veganism. And what better way to do it than with music? Oh, we don't have any sound. Like I say, what better way to do it than with music?
You know what, Cory Booker?
Uh-huh.
We got something for you.
That's right.
Hit it, Silk! Don't be messing with our meat. Well, you know we love to eat. We grill it, fry it, shake it, and bake it, and eat it with our teeth.
Yum, yum.
Don't forget the seasoning salt, the hot sauce, or the barbecue sauce to top it all off. Don't hate the cows, because you ain't down. Don't be messing with our meat.
There you go. Yes, it's pretty sad to lose such greats in the journalism field as Diamond and Silk. But we will have to endeavor to recover. There you go. Hey, folks, one of today's sponsors is BetterHelp. They're giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to BetterHelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. A lot of therapists elsewhere have long wait lists. It can take weeks or months before they can see you. But when you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs, and you'll be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. Folks, obviously, there's a lot of need for talking to a therapist at this point. If you do not have a relationship with one, if they do not have the ability to connect with you, you know, via Zoom or telephone or FaceTime or whatever, this is a great time to take advantage of what BetterHelp offers you. Once BetterHelp connects with a therapist, if you don't feel like it's a good fit, you can switch to a new one at any time for any reason. They have no additional charge. They have thousands of licensed therapists from all over the country, so they have therapists with specialties that may be available in your area. They're obviously very attuned to what's going on right now. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists that you would find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to BetterHelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, BETTER, help, HELP.com/majority report. Before we take that quick break and get to our guest, Adam Tooze, today, just a reminder, one little plug. Still looking for, and we had a couple of people respond with some helpful information, still looking for helpful information to help out a family that is looking for either a service dog or perhaps an emotional support dog. They're not 100% sure which is the best fit, but they're looking for resources for those and potential funding resources for those. For a young child with some special needs, and it is a you know, tough situation. Obviously, the stay-at-home things, but it's also apparently a good time for the child to get some companionship. So, if you have any information on that, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Just put "dog" in the subject line, and we will get that information to those folks. Thank you again for your responses up to this point. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor of History and Director of the European Institution at Institute at Columbia University, and writing a piece, The Normal Economy is Never Coming Back. Adam Tooze will be right back after this. Back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Professor of History, Director of the European Institute at Columbia University, writing in Foreign Policy, The Normal Economy is Never Coming Back. Adam Tooze, welcome back to the program.
Pleasure to be here.
So let's just, talk about you know, one of the things that has struck me and that has been sort of stunning is that there seems to be perhaps a lack of urgency amongst our lawmakers, and certainly sort of a general sense of a lack of awareness of the implications of what we're going through in the economy right now. And it seems to me a function of those trillions of dollars that the Fed pumped into the financial system and into the corporation, into the sort of the, you know, broadly speaking, corporate bailouts. So there seems to be sort of a lack of awareness of what's happening in, I don't know if you call that the real economy, but it feels like the real economy.
Yeah, I think that's about right. I mean, there's an extraordinary disconnect right now between financial markets, the stock market, the S&P 500, even more NASDAQ, and the unemployment numbers. What we're seeing out of the unemployment insurance registration systems of the states of the United States, all of them now, is quite simply the most severe economic shock that we've ever seen, including the 1930s, in the sense in which in the space of 5 weeks, we've had 26 million Americans sign on for unemployment insurance. States like Michigan have seen a surge to what looks, on paper at least, like 25% unemployment in a single month. And on the other hand, as you're saying, really from the 23rd of March onwards, which is when the rally begins, the financial markets have been bobbing back, if not to their pre-crisis levels, then at least to much more buoyant levels. And what I think the difference maker here is definitely the Fed, which really from the beginning of March has been injecting more liquidity, more loans into the financial markets than ever before. So it's a very, very peculiar balance that we're seeing right now.
Yeah, I mean, it seems so, I keep liking it to a moment where like you bump into something and you're in a state of shock before, you know, and you're suspended there for a moment and there's no reaction because you're still in a state of shock. I mean, is that what's going on, or is it that because the financial markets have been basically propped up, that nobody who usually cares about these things or ostensibly cares about these things are concerned? Like, I'm having a real trouble wrapping my head around it. I mean, it would be hard to wrap my head around it if the stock market was also falling, right? I mean, but at least there would be some sort of like semblance of parity here. But we're going through something that is unprecedented, right?
Yeah, I do. I like your image. It's a bit of that, you know, other cartoon images come to mind, like the Wile E. Coyote or something like that. You know, that sense of having gone off the cliff, and there's that moment when the character is suspended in midair by nothing other than the spinning of their feet or their wheels or something. And then the plunge comes. And the question, of course, is when does that moment of plunge come? I mean, one way of making sense of this is that it's happening to different groups of people. I mean, one of the effects of the shock is, after all, to sort of divide us very starkly between those of us who have the privilege of being able to work from home. I work from home normally most of the time anyway. My life has been very little impacted by this. And I work for an employer with a big, deep endowment. You know, nothing is changing about my life very much other than my daughter's at home, so on and so forth, right? So it's personal circumstances. So my life continues onwards, and it's people who are in that fortunate position who, after all, are the people who own most of the equity in America's stock markets. And at the other hand, at the other end of the scale are the folks who work in the shops and the bodegas and the little restaurants that run up and down Broadway that I can see from outside my window. And they are locked away in small apartments in Queens, which is also where in New York City most of the infection is happening. And their reality is starkly different from mine. And the two don't really intersect in a direct way. I mean, I think as this goes on, we are going to be seeing not just middle class in the American sense, but upper middle class Americans losing their jobs, because this is going to become a comprehensive economic crisis. But the rate it's moving at right now is that the folks who've been laid off first are those at the bottom end of the labor market and those who are most vulnerable. And it's only really when this sort of seeps through to the entire economy that we're going to be, I think, seeing a more comprehensive shock. But I'm in the same state of bewilderment as you. You would expect an economy in this kind of paralysis to look different I think part of the problem is that we can't, certainly in a city like in Manhattan, you can't go outside. I mean, I've only seen Manhattan like three blocks from, you know, the circumference from my apartment now for almost 2 months. So I don't know what downtown looks like, which is normally a bustling commercial hub, one of the great bustling commercial centers of the entire world. And it's a ghost town by all accounts. And I think when you see that and you think about all of the shop staff, the sales assistants, the warehouse people who are associated with that, that you begin to realize the depth of what we're facing here.
I want to just, because I think the last time you were on the program, we talked about your book crashed, how a decade of financial crises had changed the world. I mean, just so that people can grasp what is different between what happened in the fall, really, of 2008, I guess it was, and now, like, I mean, because we do have that split. Like, at one point, I think, obviously, I mean, we should talk about, we'll talk about this in a moment. Like, I mean, it has to, I'm in the, you know, a similar boat. I'm at home, I'm working, you know, I got to deal with my kids, but, you know, but it's, but in terms of from an economic standpoint, there's no, I don't, you know, maybe a little bit of advertising revenue, but there isn't been the shock that I know is going on. And in the financial crisis, it was different because you had the stock market plummet. It didn't go back up. You also had sort of like a building, or maybe that's the wrong word, a degrading real estate market that just at one point like was sort of slowly degrading and then fell off a cliff, which would impact a wider range of people. I mean, is that, are we sort of like, is this thing headed in sort of the opposite direction in terms of how things are happening?
No, I think we have to come back to the point that this is potentially much worse than 2007-8. In the end, in 2007-8, after all, it was that one sector, it was construction and real estate, that blew up a huge bubble supported by this extraordinary globalized system of real estate finance. The European banks were in on it as well. And when that began to unravel on both sides of the Atlantic, in the US, in Ireland, in Spain, the entire financial system came crashing down, and it's that which took the rest of the economy with it. This time round, it's really a full body check. The entire economy has shuddered to a standstill, right? The turmoil in the financial markets in March was really the anticipation, because that's what financial markets do, of this full body check. The entire economy is going to stop, right? Detroit will stop, but also all of the retail, all of the all of the restaurants, all of the travel business, it will all stop. I mean, my wife is a tour operator, and her business is basically non-existent for the rest of this year. We're not feeling this as acutely as we would, because I've got a steady job with my university. But everyone that she works with across the entire world is basically breadless for the rest of this year. And they don't even know when it's coming back. They don't know when flights are going to resume. They don't know when hotels will operate. You know, glamorous hotels in the tourist centers of all of Europe have just shut their doors, and it's not clear when they ever reopen. Now, what that then causes all of those people to do, and they're only just in the process of doing it because this is only 3 or 4 weeks old, is they reevaluate all of their spending decisions. They themselves will not be going on holiday anytime soon. No one's buying a car. No one's buying a new computer. No one's really, you know, upgrading their cell phone right now. So this will begin to ripple through the entire economy, and it's simply too soon. I mean, we've never had a shock as comprehensive as this delivered with this kind of intensity this quickly. So the numbers are only just beginning to catch up. You know, the statistics don't add up. We know that, for instance, delinquency on consumer loans, car loans and stuff, is incredibly closely correlated with unemployment numbers in the US. But the unemployment numbers have leapt from record lows to record highs in the space of 5 weeks. So it's going to be a while before those credit card delinquencies and auto loan delinquencies begin to pile up. When they do, that inflicts losses on the balance sheets of the banks. And we may 6 months to 12 months from now be dealing with very serious tension within the financial system. Remember, the real estate bust didn't start with Lehman in 08 in September. It started really in the spring of 2007. So if we're on that kind of a clock, you know, we could still be dealing with the financial fallout from this now deep inside the balance sheets of the mortgage lenders and the banks. Next spring, right. Spring 2021 would not be an unreasonable moment to be expecting some of that to be coming down the pipe.
All right. I want to get to that in a moment, because, you know, there's a question of, is there the same, I know, and I don't think there needs to be, for the devastation to be the same, but is there the same sort of like vulnerability in those financial markets that there were in 2007, which ultimately led to sort of like an exponential impact. But so what we're looking at is we just had the earthquake, and it was, you know, in the middle of the Pacific, and then the tsunami comes. And so do we have, like, is there, I mean, how do we assess that, and what will hit first?
Like, I think that's a great analogy. That's really a great analogy. We do indeed have the earthquake. We then have the tsunami, and then you've really got to hope that no one's built a nuclear reactor in the path of the tsunami, which is what happened with Japan, right, with Fukushima. That's really our question. It's like, which bits of the shoreline is this going to hit? And then when it hits, which pieces of fragile, potentially deadly economic and financial infrastructure in harm's way as that shock comes on shore? And that's what we're going to be probing all the way around the world, because another thing that's really unique about this is it's not just the tsunami in the Pacific. It's as though the entire globe had quaked. I mean, it's quite even difficult to envision this, but that's essentially what's happened to humanity, right? 81% of the workforce, not of one country, but of the entire world, is operating under various types of lockdown or immediate post-lockdown right now. The ILO, the Global Labour Organization, says it's 2.7 billion people. And it's unprecedented. So we don't know what it's like when everyone in the world simultaneously suffers this kind of a shock. Some people like you and me go on operating as normal, but people in my wife's business and people that she works with all over the world, but also street hawkers in Delhi, people operating little grocery stores in Lagos in Nigeria, they've all simultaneously been hit. And we don't know how this organism reacts when you try and come back from that kind of a shock. Because normally we rely on the stronger bits pulling the weaker bits out and so on. Right now it's not clear whether any bit of the global economy has basically retained its dynamism and that can pull us ashore from here. So it's extraordinarily dramatic in that sense in its comprehensiveness. And the way it's affected literally every sector, every economy in the world simultaneously.
Okay, so having established the sort of the scope of what we're looking at, let's just sort of tease this out in terms of like the depth in which it hits. Let's just pretend in a parallel universe that. In a week, the scientists come out and say, like, this is really strange, but Donald Trump was right. It just, as soon as we got into the first week of May, the heat came and the whole thing disappeared. Everybody can go back out today, on May 15th, we're fine. So, you know, pick up the pieces and get back to work. I mean, presumably, if that happened, right, things there'd be some stuff to work out through the system. But more or less, we would be fine, right? If that's the case,
unless you're one of the 26 million people who've lost their job already, so they would all have to go back to the businesses that laid them off, and they'd have to hope. And that is what the data shows, that currently the vast majority of those layoffs are temporary. So right. It implies that businesses that the people were laid off by are still there. The question really is, 2 or 3 months from now, will those businesses still be there, or will they be bankrupt? Will they have been wiped out in the meantime? If those people can go back to those businesses intact, then indeed, yes, one could imagine what the economists call a V-shaped recovery coming out of this. But it's really a matter of time. If this lasts into the summer, the lockdowns in the key economic centers of the US, and crucially, not only if the lockdowns are lifted, but if consumer and investor confidence doesn't return, because it's all very well for the governor to say it's all right for you to go out now, but we actually have to believe it's all right and that we're willing to take the risk that's involved in going out and accept that risk on all our families, all the stuff that we now fully understand, right? We'll still not be going out and spending money the way we used to in restaurants. We still won't be going out to the mall because we'll have gotten used to getting things delivered and whatnot. So that shock will persist. The time factor, I think, is absolutely crucial, and also the credibility of the return. If we're skeptical about how safe we actually are, if we're skeptical about the ability of the medical system to cope if we do get ill, and especially if we're hit by a second or third wave of our viral infection, then this changes confidence, and that changes, it may feel sort of a flimsy sort of argument, but there is nothing worse for an economy than a comprehensive loss of confidence on the part of consumers and investors. And you can see that, we'll be able to pick it up statistically in the way in which consumer behavior changes. So if consumption goes down, if saving goes up, sounds like a good thing to do from the point of view of an individual household, and it may very well be the safe thing to do, allows you to build wealth. But if that happens collectively across the entire economy, that doesn't work out, because what that will do is cut demand and send us into a downward spiral. And the real worry is that those forces of recession, if you like, might take over.
So, okay. And so just in my little scenario, we get that V-shaped economy, but then we know that there is a date, and we don't know exactly how long it is. And that's, and whether it's 2 months or 3 months or 4 months, when those jobs just go away because those firms close down, that's really a function of how much money, how much aid, essentially, Congress decides to pump in there. And
that's why credit is so crucial. Yeah, that's why credit is. We're all living on credit right now, and we need the financial system to remain intact to be able to provide that. And that's why the interventions by the Fed were so critical in March. I mean, again, you're ending up lending money to people who are rich and everything else. But what that enables you to do is to sustain the credit system, because as you're saying, we need that to get us through.
Well, and I want to
really need. Yeah.
I want to talk about the disparity too of lending. I mean, obviously, we need to lend, and we lent to basically wealthy people and wealthy institutions that can lend credit to other people. But by doing so, what we're also doing is increasing wealth inequality. We could have theoretically provided this credit essentially to everybody else, which would have been in the form of far more generous, let's say, unemployment insurance or direct payments, or you know, even things like you, congratulations, you're now on free healthcare. I mean, all of those are in some form essentially providing credit that we can basically relieve, you know, can basically say, we're going to forgive that debt, incidentally, 6 months down the road. But that credit that we, that the government essentially provided for people is basically just keeping everybody in sort of this, you know, sort of stasis and paying everybody to just sort of protect society in some fashion. And at this point, we've only paid one. We've only provided credit for one segment of the economy, and one which ultimately, like, that's going to run out at one point too. So, I mean, do we have a sense of where we'll start to see this first, assuming no more money? Like, what generally in the economy, where you would have where consumer spending starts to dry up? We're seeing it obviously with like small businesses, right? Restaurants and whatnot, because they don't have the capital to maintain that stasis.
They've got bills to pay, rent bills to pay, and they're in real trouble. I think we're going to see it above all in the sectors that were vulnerable anyway. You know, before this crisis hit, we spent a lot of time talking about the increasing inequality, not just in American society between higher and lower income households, but also between in the business sector, between the superstar firms, if you like, and those that were just getting by. And there's a huge part of the US economy, like every other advanced economy, that really is just getting by. Most of the profits in business as a whole are made in that superstar group that dominates the S&P 500. Everyone else is just kind of, you know, really hanging on. And a shock like this tips those companies over the edge. And the sort of places that you're really going to see it is the famous, you know, the long-awaited collapse of certain sorts of retail model, which I think probably are going to get the coup de grace in this crisis. Even on Broadway, where I live, if you walk up and down, you know, you've got an Urban Outfitters, for instance, a sort of classic victim of this process, which announced early on in the lockdown, the 23rd of March was their last day that they were going to be open. That outlet is shut, and everyone who works there has probably lost their job forever. So those are the sorts of sectors where I think we're really going to see this, where we're going to see the permanent damage being done. Those are sectors which have been traditionally employers of a lot of women, female workers, middling levels of education. They've been one of the places that middle-class American families have gone to sustain themselves, as the classic blue-collar male jobs have gone away. And those jobs now, the jobs done by women, are also in at considerable risk. So those are the sorts of sectors where I'd look to see the damage.
I mean, it's almost, I guess, to extend that metaphor with the tsunami, these are the sort of the low-lying flats near the beach, essentially. And then the higher ground is, are these big, massive mega firms that essentially...
And they come out of this stronger, I think. Their competition gets wiped out. Relatively speaking, they come out of the stronger. And as you're saying, but almost by default, you know, if you take a society characterized by large inequality and then you put it through a crisis like this and you try and rescue it, the people that swim ashore, the people that are able to take advantage of the government support, even if the government is in fact in its own way trying to countersteer against this, tend to be those with the best connections, with the best banking connections, with the best lawyers, accountants, and so on. And they get their noses in the trough first. And so it's not surprising. I think the last figure I saw was that only 5% of American small businesses have seen any payout yet from the, you know, the payroll protection plan.
Right. Well, there's so not going to be, very, I mean, there's simply, there, I mean, A, there was simply not enough money, but B, it went to, like you said, if you have like concierge service at your bank, because you're a big client, you're going to get in there first, and that's it. And because the banks themselves are determining who they're going to send to the, you know, they're determining the order of the applications they're going to send to the SBA.
Absolutely. And I think the banks felt incredibly uncomfortable about it. Like, banks under normal circumstances do a lot of kind of quasi law and order type of, you know, money laundering enforcement, all that kind of stuff. We're all familiar with the paperwork that's associated with that. Now, all of a sudden, as you say, they found themselves in this process of doing a kind of selection of the companies. That was built into the legislation that the banks are going to have that job. I mean, they'll receive fees for it, but nevertheless, it's...
They got paid fairly handsomely, but the problem is that they're conflicted in terms of who they're going to put first in line, because they obviously want to put their better clients in first in line because they want to make sure that those clients stick around.
Absolutely. And that is the brutal logic of this kind of process, right? I mean, we end up supporting the big players because the big players also employ a lot of people and they matter to the welfare of the American economy. It's a kind of triage, right? That's operating at the level of the economic system. And it cuts against the desire to be egalitarian. It cuts against the desire to preserve the little guy, who at that moment just doesn't have the same systemic importance as propping up a really big employer. You know, we might all want to come down hard on the airlines because they treat their customers so shabbily and we know what they've been doing with their profits over the years. On the other hand, they're really large employers. They're crucial to the regional economy to many parts of the US. And after all, when this is all done with, we're going to have to fly again. So, you know, the impulse to regulate and to discipline an actor that has basically been, as we, I mean, all study after study has shown, taking advantage of an oligopolistic position to squeeze advantage for themselves. At this moment of crisis, it doesn't seem like the right moment to, you know, just pragmatically, it doesn't appear to be the right moment to put the screws on.
Well, I mean, let me just push back on that just a little bit as we move into sort of like the second phase of this. And as we talk about sort of the water, you know, starting to like pour onto the beach and into the low level ground. It almost seems like, you know, premature, but how we respond to what we do now is sort of built into how we respond now. Right. I mean, so like we use the airlines as an example. On one hand, we're talking about how crucial they are. I mean, they're too big to fail, right? I mean, that is the argument, essentially. And, but at that point, like, you know, one of the responses could be, hey, we just discovered something that's too big to fail. That's a job for government to do. Like, you know, we're now going to have part of what you have because you have shown that, like, that A, we have established that this service, airlines, in 2008, it could have been banks, are crucial to the functioning of society. Right. However, you have not been the proper steward for this service to society because you sucked, you know, so much money out of your business to essentially line your pockets with buybacks and whatnot. We could have made the same argument about the Boeing 737 MAX. Folks know that story about how that was like, instead of putting it onto R&D and redeveloping that that plane, they came up with this sort of big Band-Aid that sometimes slips off. You know, we could at that point as a society say, like, we're going to have to own part of this because you have shown an inability to steward this, what we consider so crucial to our society that we're willing to bail it out, this service.
I don't disagree. I mean, my personal favorite right now is the fossil fuel industry, in which I believe we could buy a controlling stake. The entire fossil fuel industry of the world, given the depressed price of oil and gas. And at this point, you know, a couple of $100 billion puts you in a, which, you know, in terms of the money that we've been throwing around here is peanuts, would give you an absolutely dominant shareholding position in all of the major oil and gas companies of the Western world at this moment. And from the point of view of addressing the climate crisis, which is clearly, you know, the great crisis that we thought was going to dominate the headlines of this year, that would totally change the game. So the force of that, I think, is extremely compelling. There are two questions, and I'm going to play devil's advocate here, just for the sake of argument, that push back against that. The first is simply, in the crisis, is your priority to, as it were, save what can be saved, or to pursue transformation? And what is the price of pursuing a transformational agenda at this moment? Would you damage confidence even further? Would you have a larger investor strike if you were seen to be playing rough at this moment? And that, I think, is one of the concerns. And the second, of course, is that this is all entirely hypothetical because the people in power in Washington, D.C. right now are stone-cold Republicans, and they have no interest whatsoever in pursuing this kind of argument. So it's a hypothetical. And one really needs to be asking oneself, how do you build a political coalition to push through this kind of transformational agenda at this moment? And is this crisis going to get us there? And after all, one of the kind of remarkable things of this moment is that the Sanders campaign folded, and it folded virtually without, you know, without noise. It was almost the sort of just accompanying music in a scene that was entirely dominated by the urgencies of the crisis. That fundamental, you know, a transformation, therefore, in the political complexion of the United States going forward into next year, because the choices are now between Biden and Trump, happened, you know, without very little drama. And yet that, of course, decides the possibility of any of the sort of transformational politics that you and I might like, or that one might think of as being appropriate in this crisis.
Let me, I will certainly concede, and knowing that you're playing a devil's advocate here, I'll certainly concede number two. Number one, I guess I would argue, is just that we're going through transformational politics whether we like it or not. It's just a question of who gets to, who's in charge of what the transformation looks like, in my mind. And it does definitely feel like, there's really one side in this. One side is like, we're going to make it a completely dominated by a couple of firms. And the other side is saying, it appears like you're going to make it completely dominant. I mean, there does not seem to be two sides to the argument here, as we see now. And at one point in your piece, you're talking about that central banks can continue to sort of pump money into the economy. And you write, to the conventional mind, debt must be eventually repaid through surpluses generated through tax increases or spending cuts. In other words, and I feel like we're still in the midst of, like, we're still riding on one of those waves of that tsunami that we can't really assess the damage yet. But what you're suggesting is that what tends to follow these things, and certainly in Europe in 2008, 9, 10, it did more so than in the United States, but still to a certain extent, there was a pivot to it in 2010 in the United States, is austerity. And McConnell's already trying to impose that on the states at this point. If one did not have a conventional mind, what would be the other options Like, what could we be setting up now so that we would not, or at least building a narrative now so that we would not have to deal with austerity, which was, I think, an unequivocal failure in Europe. I mean, we can still see the social and political implications of it, if not economic, in Europe.
And in the United States as well. And I think you're absolutely right to bring up the issue of the state-level politics here, because if you look at the response to the 08-09 crisis in the US, everything the federal government did was largely offset by the tightening at the state level, the city level, you know, where we saw savage cuts in many states to spending on essentials like education. This is really where the crisis of public education in so many of the red states of the United States begins, is in the squeeze that followed 08-09. And folks like McConnell directly were complicit in this. And they were complicit also, I mean, in the terms of austerity in 2010, because that's not, I mean, the Obama administration included a lot of Clinton veterans who were quite hard on the deficit, but they were driven in that direction by the just the blanket stonewall resistance of the GOP in Congress that McConnell was the leader of. Right? I mean, he said he wanted Obama to be a one-term president. That was his main mission in politics. So absolutely, I think this is really a crucial issue. Is not in the first instance, you know, in the crisis itself, but especially when you've got a Republican president. Then, of course, and it's an election year, then the taps are full on. But if Joe Biden wins in November, expect the entire conservative political machine, along with its media, to pivot on a dime. And from then on in, it'll be deficits and debt as the central issue that's threatening the United States. For people of a different political persuasion, my basic advice is just don't talk about debt. And that's not a counsel of irresponsibility. Don't talk about debt. Debt doesn't have to be an issue. It doesn't have to be an issue for two basic reasons, or three, really. It doesn't have to be an issue for the United States, because the United States is the issuer of the dominant currency in the world. Everyone in the world wants dollars and can use dollars. This crisis has only reaffirmed that. America is not going to be subject to the blackmail of foreign creditors. America is not in the position of a household when it borrows. It is the ultimate global sovereign debtor, if you like. So America is not constrained in the way that an Argentina is, for instance. That's the first issue. Secondly, right now, it's incredibly cheap to borrow because interest rates are low. So even if the debt numbers are huge, the interest rate that the Americans pay on this is derisory. So it's really a small price to pay for investments that are essential right now to sustain life in the US, get normal life back to normal, and ideally, of course, begin that process of transformation. Because I liked the point you made earlier on, that really this is about transformation, and the question is, what direction does this go in? And the third reason is that once again, we've demonstrated the basic truth in this crisis, as we did in 08-09, which is that public debt is different, because public debt is an asset which is used by everyone for the purposes of long-term investing, for safe investing, and is managed by and has a prime claim on the attention of the Federal Reserve, the central bank. And ultimately, debt which is owed by the federal government but held by the central bank is quite literally debt that we owe to ourselves, money that we owe to ourselves. And to the extent that we owe it to ourselves, it's essentially might as well not be a matter of concern, because it shows up on both sides of our public balance sheet. It shows up as a debit on one side of the federal government, but as a credit on the balance sheet of the central bank. So it's just not something that we need to be concerned about. There is a flip side to that, which is the central bank money issued by the central bank in exchange for the debt that it buys. But that and that could, under certain circumstances, trigger inflation. But we are a million miles away from a world in which inflation of that type is going to happen. So for all of those reasons, we should just not be worrying about debt. We should really not even be, if we can possibly be, engaging on the terrain of debt politics. Because anyone who raises that at this point is really raising a red herring. And you've got to ask why they're doing that.
Well, they're doing it because they want to, I guess the analogy I've been using in terms of that first stimulus was that, you know, everybody's under the yellow flag except for a narrow set of wealthy elite. And when they get that money, they're zooming around the racetrack and they want to maintain that dynamic, essentially. And that's where talk of debt comes in. We need the austerity is for everybody else, essentially.
Well, it's for those who are dependent on, you know, quote unquote entitlements, for instance, or at the federal, at the state level, at the local level, the people who are reliant on public schooling or the public infrastructure rather than private schools and could afford to take look after themselves through those kind of mechanisms. So indeed, yes, the debt is really a kind of albatross that you hang around the neck of the public sector. And I basically suspect anyone of bad faith who even raises the issue. That's what I was trying to get at with this notion of like the conventional mind, which I take to be basically a conservative position that misunderstands the nature of government debt and treats it as analogous to that of a private household, which is basically just a false analogy. It's misleading, and its politics are profoundly conservative.
So in the event that we are in a position where, you know, the only response, I mean, it does feel like on some level that the way that we get to non-austerity policies is to drive up that debt so large that it's just an impossible task to sort of like refill those coffers and just force almost, you know, whoever's in power on the other side of this crisis. I mean, you know, again, to go back to that analogy, the water comes in, at one point it recedes, and then you're just sitting there in the wreckage. We're still in the process of the water, like it hasn't even hit the beach yet on some level. And so we don't even know how far inland it's going to go. But when we get to the other side where we are surveying the wreckage after the water has receded, on some level, it sounds like we need to have so much debt that the only answer is to just look at those, basically those accounting, those spreadsheets, and just go, we're just going to zero balance it across the, you know, on this ledger and that ledger.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk Turkey here. I mean, what the Democrats should not do is submit to the blackmail, which they submitted to twice already, which was that the Reagan deficits were run up as a combination of military spending and tax cuts, were then worked down by the Clinton administration, which submitted to the blackmail of responsibility in fiscal policy and made it its job to cut the deficits. And then the Bush deficits, again, run up due to wars of choice on the one hand, and huge tax cuts in the middle of those wars of choice became the legacy of the Obama administration. And the Obama administration, forced its hand in part by the non-cooperation of the Republicans, made it its job to stabilize the budget again. And so this is a completely one-sided political game in which, as it were, the Democrats are responsible for restoring, quote unquote, the fiscal credibility of the United States. And the Republicans use the capital stored up in that process then to line the nests of their voters who are in favor of both high spending on the one hand, especially on the military, and tax cuts on the other. And no incoming Democratic administration should submit to that blackmail again. And the answer to that is indeed, as you say, simply to call their bluff and to say, look, we can run deficits too. These are our priorities as opposed to your priorities. Our priorities don't include tax cuts for the rich, and they don't include massive military spending. They do include high spending on infrastructure. We would talk about taxes, but we would want to concentrate them progressively on those of higher income and wealth. And we will run whatever deficit is necessary to achieve our objectives of full employment and sustainable transformation of the American economy. And then we'll figure out how we deal with the debt afterwards, right? And anyone who tries to argue from the Republican side at this point about debt, it just needs to have their bluff called, because a look at the track record of the last, not the last 10 years, but the last 40 years, all the way back to the 1980s. So yes, indeed, this is a message, of course, that has to be driven home to Biden and the team of advisors around Biden, because, you know, they are the Democratic hope now. And we know that, broadly speaking, Biden is a completely conventional centrist Democrat, and folks like Larry Summers are amongst those advising him. And they have been part, two times over, of consolidation efforts within the American budget under Democratic administrations. And it would really be a historic tragedy if a Biden administration was to renew that agenda, because it just simply hands the game to the Republicans every time.
I'd be remiss if I also didn't point out that Nancy Pelosi is of that ilk. I mean, she, Pete Peterson acolyte, she was talking about, if we take back the House, we're going to install a PAYGO, which basically means that we cannot deficit spend. She's
Barack Obama himself, you know, would talk about belt tightening.
Yes.
I mean, it's bad economics and it's worse politics. And it's disabling. And it's part historically of the deal that was done between the Clinton team and Rubin from, you know, Goldman Sachs in the 1990s. We know exactly what the trap was. We know what its political advantages were. certain sorts of risks went away. You made peace with Alan Greenspan. You made peace with Wall Street. It was good for the coffers of certain sorts of elite Democrats in terms of campaign funds and so on. It put them in contention to compete head on head with the Republicans in terms of money raising. But in terms of actually progressive politics, especially given the pressures of rising inequality, you know, a real catastrophe for certain segments of American society, it's been devastating for the credibility of the Democrats amongst that kind of electorate.
All right. So lastly, let me ask you this. I mean, I know this is almost an impossible task because we still, I think, don't have a clear picture of what we're dealing with. But if you were to be in a position where I don't know how this would work out, but Joe Biden would come to you and say, like, listen, Adam, I'm giving you one thing off your wish list. What's the most important thing that I will do? And I will do it after I assume dictatorial powers on January 21st. What would be the one program that you think would have the most, sort of like, you know, a broad program that have the most impact in terms of dealing what we can only anticipate we're going to be dealing with in 6 months, 10 months?
I do think in the end that the Green New Deal vision is the one to go for. That had already demonstrated its ability to mobilize a large segment of the progressive coalition. It speaks directly to the needs of the United States in terms of the energy transition. It speaks to the need to create, you know, well-paid, high-quality jobs with real future prospects. And it's doable. This isn't a moonshot. Well, it is a moonshot, and the moonshot was doable. We're talking about 2-4% of GDP that needs to be mobilized, and it would have a transformative effect. And in the end, it's basically win-win. So, you know, it reduces the amount of completely unnecessary fuel bills that we spend, you know, that we spend on fuel bills for fossil fuels that we shouldn't be using. So that would be my number one priority, that one would inject some of the energy of the Green New Deal coalition into a Biden administration. It's a long shot in political terms,
right,
given what we know about his background, but that would be the thing that I think they ought to adopt. And I think it ought to be an easy sell. This is not something that actually is, I think it's in a sense a failure of imagination on the part of centrists like himself. When you've got folks like Bloomberg, for instance, who are really quite serious about the energy transformation agenda and quite radical in the way in which they're willing to think not just about stimulating green, but cracking down hard on brown fuels. Gas is, you know, coal is the no-brainer, but gas, fracked gas, and then oil are really those are the hard bullets that need to be bitten. And that's where I think, you know, it would be great if they would deploy political courage. Other people will make the case for various types of universal healthcare. I think that's absolutely legitimate core. And there are some difficult trade-offs to be argued through here, even if one imagined that about Biden administration would in fact be a genuinely progressive one. But that would be my own personal plug.
And to be clear, the Green New Deal is essentially a federal jobs program, a massive federal jobs program and federal investment program.
Well, in the AOC version, and it was my own, and I see nothing wrong.
I'm sorry, Adam, we're having something's happening with our audio. You're breaking up a little bit. Let's try it again. We may have to actually leave it there. For some reason, we're having some type of audio. I don't know. The internet has been a little bit funky. But Adam Tooze, if you can hear me, thank you so much for your time today. Really interesting stuff. We will put a link to your piece, The Normal Economy is Never Coming Back, on our website at majority.fm. Please stay safe, and thank you again for joining us. All right. I'm going to assume that was you saying goodbye because we couldn't break it here.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, folks, sorry about that. Don't know what happened, but there it is. We are we are just oddly in the midst of this. It is both a severe acute crisis in a way that is unprecedented in the history of this country, and maybe the history of the world, frankly. But as, I mean, this is the paradox, as acute as it is right now, as a society, we can't feel it because we're, you know, still essentially indoors. I mean, I think, obviously, if you have lost your job, as millions of people have, you are acutely aware of this. But as a society, in terms of what it's done to our economy, I just don't think that we have the ability to recognize it yet. It's almost like, you know, a tornado is hit in the middle of the night, and you know, you look out your window and it's just dark. You can't tell what's going on, and I don't know when. In that metaphor, the morning comes and we look out and survey the damage. But we are still in the midst of that tornado essentially raging in the middle of the night. And it is, I think the important thing for folks to do is to be mindful and to continue to push for policies that, because the decisions that are made now will implicate how we build back later. And so we need to be conscious of that. And I say that on a day where it's announced that the House is still, and it's enraging to me, not coming back to do their effing job. And I don't care if you need to commandeer a hotel and quarantine Congress people and have a shuttle bus that takes them and test every one of them as they get into the hotel, make sure they're fine, and then shuttle them to the House. But this is just absurd. The idea that our lawmakers 6 weeks in are still not as important to what's going on in our society as the folks we make work at the supermarket. It's outrageous. It's outrageous. We will talk more about this in a moment. I think Noma Key should be joining us shortly. I don't know if she has the...
She's in the waiting room, actually.
Oh, she is? Yeah, bring her in. She can talk about what she's talking about on her show. And as Matt does that, I will remind you this program relies on a support from its members to keep on trucking. Every day we do our best to bring you some interesting interviews if we can, or discussion of the news, and maintain our technology. It's always something. But if you have the ability to support the program, join themajorityreport.com. If you do not have the ability to support the program, but you still want access to the fun half, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. If you've been a member and you're worried about it going forward, head over back to your membership page. We got some options for you there as you attempt to cancel. So check that out. Also, don't forget, this is not just coffee branded, but it is. That's the way I'm drinking my coffee now. By the, I go through a thing of those basically a day. There you go. Nomi's got hers as well.
Just right.
JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Oh, also, I should tell you, the AM Quickie, I think we're going to move it over to our second Majority Report channel. That is Majority Report Audio on YouTube. But you can still get it via a podcast, of course, at amquickie.com. So check that out. 6-7 minutes of headline news every day. Don't forget TMBS tonight. You can check it out at patreon.com/TMBS or youtube.com, The Michael Brooks Show. Also, The Antifada. Find Jamie doing the show at patreon.com/TheAntifada. I think that's it. And Nomiki. Nomiki.
Hi.
What is, what's happening on your show?
What's happening on my show? Well, we are still talking about, because there was just so much to discuss, where we go from here. This week's show, specifically, I discuss what's going to happen with down ballot races, challengers, grassroots challengers, and why it's super important that it's all hands on deck. And if we want to concentrate our energy towards something super productive, it would definitely be down ballot races, because the big moneyed interests have, you know, they have the ability to buy ads and more digital in the era of COVID, and our power as a movement is knocking on doors. So that's a big part of the next show. We also have Micah Utrecht, which, you know, we actually planned the interview far back, and he has his book out with Megan Day from Jacobin, both of them from Jacobin, called Bigger Than Bernie. And Harvey K comes on because, you know, we always have to check in with Harvey K, as you know too well.
Well, I mean, if there's good any timing. Template for what needs to happen with the government, it is, yep. You know, FDR provided it for Absolutely. Us. And we need, we're going to need a lot of that and more. Yep. Matt, what's happening on Literary Hangover?
Yeah, over at twitch.tv/literaryhangover last night, I played Half-Life 2 while listening to 1984 by George Orwell. So it's a really good mix. I think people were kind of blown away by the ingenuity of combining those two things. So check that out. Go subscribe, twitch.tv/literaryhangover.
Who did the voiceover for 1984?
It's some volunteer guy. Somehow. It's on YouTube, actually. Yeah. I don't know how it's copyright safe, but it was on Twitch. So check that out while it lasts, I guess.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. Headed to the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number.
So funny.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird.
No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.